Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 185 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet Gillian Allnutt speaks with Jeff Hattersley about poetry and role models, her work with asylum seekers, and the contrasting influences of teaching and meditation on her writing.
Gillian Allnutt was born in London, but spent half her childhood in Newcastle-upon-Tyne and now lives in County Durham. She read philosophy and English at Cambridge and was poetry editor of City Limits magazine from 1983 to 1988. She also co-edited the landmark anthology The New British Poetry, published by Paladin Books in 1988. Her collections include Nantucket and the Angel from 1997 and Lintel from 2001, both of which were shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. Blue Dax Books published How the Bicycle Shone, New and Selected Poems, in 2007, which received a Poetry Book Society special commendation. I spoke to Gillian about her poetry, about her work with asylum seekers in the North East, about the influence of meditation on her poetry, and on her being the recipient of the Queen's Medal for Poetry in 2017. Hello, Gillian. It's very nice to meet you.
Hello, Jeff.
I was in Glasgow recently interviewing Donny O'Rourke for the Royal Literary Fund, and he said that he ardently believes that poetry can, and in fact should, change lives. How do you feel about that?
I think it can if you find the right poet at the right moment. When I was young and starting out with writing, I remember the first time I joined a women's writing group. That was in 1976. At a place called the Women's Arts Alliance in London. I felt as if the other women in the group understood what I'd written before I wrote it, and that was completely different from the mixed groups, the men friends I'd been showing poems to before. Not that they weren't sympathetic and interested, but somehow being on the same wavelength as the other people in the group was obviously hugely encouraging. And so I suppose the existence of the women's writing group changed the possibilities of writing for me.
Back in the 80s, of course, you were one of the editors of the New British Poetry, which took, in a way, it was a much more representative anthology than anything that had been before. And perhaps it was a bit of a reaction to that Penguin Book of Contemporary British Poetry.
Oh, yes.
In which I think there were about 18 writers, maybe three women. And, it certainly helped to change the landscape as well, because it would be almost unthinkable now to bring out a book like that Penguin Book, which underrepresents women so drastically.
Yes.
Things have definitely changed now, you know. Far more women are being published. Far more women are receiving the accolades. We, in fact, even have a poet laureate who is a woman.
Well, I do think I've realised the helpfulness of having a woman poet laureate. And as you'll know, part of her job is to head the selection committee that chooses the poet to receive the Queen's Gold Medal each year. And so I have just been to see the Queen to get the medal. And one of the things that particularly pleased me about that was that all of the Queen and Carol Ann Duffy and myself are women. And that couldn't have happened before Carol Ann's reign as laureate. I found in the course of my adult life that every so often I've seen a woman, and this is where you can make changes through being a role model. I remember when I saw Jane Glover conduct, I think it was Messiah in the Festival Hall a long time ago, and she kept tucking her blouse back into her skirt, because, you know, we saw her back all through, and I totally identified with that. And I thought, I could have been a conductor. Right. And the same when Jo Cox was killed. And because she was involved with asylum seekers, which I have been myself. And then I was watching on YouTube, I think, a little piece of footage of her speaking on behalf of refugee children in the House of Commons, and all of a sudden it opened up and I thought, oh, I could have been an MP. Not that I would have been an MP, but suddenly it became possible. Because of that, being able to identify with the role model. There was a role model that I'd never been before. But hopefully I can do that as a poet for other women, and they'll think, oh, I could have been a poet, or I could be a poet.
You say you've worked with Asylum Seekers yourself. I know you had a residency in 2009 with Freedom from Torture, working with Asylum Seekers in the North East.
Yes.
What was that work entailing exactly?
It was initially a six-month residency. The job description allowed for 14 full days of work over a period of 6 months, which to my mind was ludicrously little, given what you were supposed to do, which was set up writing groups across Stockton, Sunderland, Middlesbrough and Newcastle and Gateshead, with asylum seekers who don't have the money for the bus fare, and run these groups of people who all spoke different languages and come up with a product, like a performance or an installation or a book or some CD or something.
Yeah.
Over 14 days' work in 6 months. And so when I applied, I said, this is ridiculous. And the interviewers, two of them said, yes, we know, yes, and then offered me the job. And, yeah, it was just one of the most amazing experiences in my life. I felt, for whatever reasons really, that I was in the right place at the right time, and I just put everything into it really.
So did you end up with a book or something out of the experience?
Yes, we produced this book, The Galloping Stone.
All right.
Which has work from about 16 people, I think, both clients, asylum seekers and staff, counsellors and some volunteers and the administrator. I mean, it felt like, what's the point of having a writer in residence when these people have nothing but their mobile phone? That was something that struck me. Every asylum seeker has a mobile phone. And even if they've got no credit on it, they're contactable. And they might not have a roof over their heads, no money for food, no food vouchers, no right to stay even, you know, till next week. And, you know, when people are in that sort of dire straits, writing. And I thought, I mean, I have my own agenda, really. I personally wanted to explore what it might mean to give and not to count the cost in my own life, here and now. And also, I was very interested in listening. And also, I thought, well, Freedom from Torture is a counselling organisation. They're telling their grisly tales to the counsellors, and I'm not going to ask for them. And I never did. And that was an intuitive decision that turned out to be right. And if people talked about their journey, their flight, their reasons for leaving, their experiences of, I don't know, rape and torture and so on, if they chose to, I listened. And sometimes their counsellors would tell me something about what had happened to the people that I was working with, and I listened, but I never asked. I decided that I would try to deal with happier times, and I very tentatively ask people about their childhood, usually their earlier lives in their own country, being ready to stop if they found it very difficult, but they didn't. And so I used my most tried and tested creative writing exercises, really, to help people talk and then write.
What were the nationalities of the people then? Were they all coming from?
They were either, apart from one from Kyrgyzstan, which was very unusual, they were from Iran, Iraq, and Africa. So Somalia, Ethiopia, Guinea, Sierra Leone, Zimbabwe.
Most of the women, or was it mixed?
Mixed. In fact, there are a lot more men asylum seekers than women, about 2 to 1, I think. And they were, I think probably their average age was around 30, but they were anything from 20 to 55, I think, was the oldest one I worked with. And the older you are, the harder it is, I think. Not because of the physical privations of the journey, but because you have so much more to lose. You're leaving behind an established life and status and so on in your own country.
So most poets, I think, or many poets who see politics as being part of the art, they tend to perhaps try more for accessibility than you have. You know, you've never really given the impression of being a poet who tries so hard to be easily understood. You know, and do you think that's fair to say? Or
I think I've got more and more difficult to understand. That wasn't deliberate. I mean, I suppose that my social context was feminism to start with, and probably. Yeah. I never called myself a feminist poet. I would stretch to call myself a woman poet.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, a lot of the work was quite feminist. And so I had a shared context, a shared constituency, really. But mostly my base, my context, my constituency has been through teaching, which is less obviously political. I mean, most of my poems for many years started in writing workshops. I always make people write in sessions because I think it makes the writing more alive. And I write myself for reasons of trust and democracy and equality. I think that's really important too.
So your own poems were written in these workshops?
They would start in workshops.
Yeah.
But in fact, at some point I realised if I was going to have something to read out after 20, 30, 40 minutes of writing, it worked much better if I wrote prose. And, I mean, sometimes I would be completely stumped by my own exercises, and yeah. I think it was good for them when I would sit there saying, oh, I couldn't do anything with this.
Yeah.
And but that didn't often happen. Mostly, I mean, I wanted to lay myself on the line, which I think is really important when it comes to art. Any art. And so in order to be able to lay myself on the line through reading out, I took to writing prose, and then when I got it home, I would sit down at the computer and type it out one sentence per line, usually. I mean, completely obvious way of doing it, and then work from there to the poem. So it changed my working practice. When I got the Northern Rock Writers Award and was expected to give up some of my paid work in the world so that other writers could benefit, and I, being me, gave up the lot, then I thought, oh, what's writing going to be attached to now if it's not teaching? And it attached itself to meditation. Oh. And that was something quite else, really.
Do you mean like transcendental meditation?
Well, I do meditation actually every day. I very rarely miss, and I've had a number of sources to learn my practice from, if you like. I did a 6-week beginner's course with the Newcastle Buddhist Society.
Right.
And then I did spend 5 years going to Quaker meetings in Durham from 2008 to 13. And I still belong to a WCCM local meditation group. That's World Community for Christian Meditation.
Right.
It's so unmemorable, but it's WCCM, that's how everyone knows it, and it's a worldwide movement started in this country. So I'm quite eclectic in my practice, really. Sometimes I feel it's very destructive. I feel as if I'm sitting there almost tearing holes in my mind. I'm trying not to think. I'm trying to get beyond the mind. And that's sort of led to a practice in poetry of breaking down complete sentences and moving very much towards fragments and making huge gaps like holes in the mind.
Yeah.
And that is difficult. And in fact, but 3 or 4 years ago, I made a New Year resolution to come back from that because I felt I was just writing myself into silence, and that didn't seem like a very good idea, really.
So. There has always been a spiritual aspect to your writing, I think, right from Blackthorn, which is the first book I read of yours. You know. Are you a Christian? Do you believe in God? Or?
I won't call myself a Christian any more than I'll call myself a feminist now, because
right.
I think it has the effect of making other people's ear flaps close down.
Right.
It has such a negative press, and I'm not a practicing Christian in the sense that my mother was. I mean, I suppose she gives me my definition of
right.
practicing Christian. She went to church in Church of England all her life and gifted me Christianity, for which I'm very grateful. I mean, my poetry is riddled with Christianity and Christian imagery because, I mean, as a child I went to 2 Catholic convents before I was 11. We always went to church in the Church of England. My father was a lapsed Baptist, I suppose, but his family were all Baptists, and so there was a hefty dose. And when I went to university, I stopped going. going to church, and I haven't really gone back again apart from the 5 years with Quakers, which doesn't count as church really in my book. I think it's very, very difficult for Quakers at the moment. It's a very interesting time because they describe themselves as an organisation with their roots in Christianity, yeah. Which seems to me a very good description. Quakers are brilliant at words. But nevertheless, a lot of meetings and larger gatherings of Quakers seem to divide between those who want to see it as a Christian organisation and those who don't.
I would just say to them, a politically active organisation.
Yes. Yeah. Somebody said to me when I started going to Quaker meetings, social witness is what the Quakers do really, really well. And they are. I mean, it is their work in the world, I think, that's immensely valuable.
So your own poems can often be quite difficult. You know, I mean, I found myself sometimes that I have to read them more than once. You have to read them more than once to really get into them and what they're saying. How do they work at readings? I've never seen you read. Do you generally try to read simple ones at readings, or do you just give them what's coming and leave them to it? Does an audience pick up on what you're doing without knowing the poem first, do you think?
Increasingly, I give much longer introductions than the poems themselves. Right. There's a growing imbalance between the two because I do try to prepare the ground for the shortest, most difficult, most cryptic and gnomic and fragmented poems. But people have always said, oh, I really liked your introduction. And you know, it's like, did you like the poem? But so I do try to give them enough that they can get something from a single hearing,
yeah.
I hope. I find it increasingly difficult to know whether or not to have footnotes or notes, and if so, what should go in them. It's very interesting. Over the 30 or 40 years I've been writing, I used to know exactly what in a poem needed a footnote because I knew who my audience was. And now it's gone so global.
Yeah.
You can't calculate it. And I mean, I must say, The Temptation with Indwelling, which was probably the most difficult book I've ever written, the last one, I just wanted to put Google it at the bottom of every page. And I mean, that is the saving grace, really. That's where it's changed. You don't have to give people footnotes because they have the choice to Google it and they will find it. And that was never the case before. So, and I've also, I think, moved away in myself from wanting desperately to understand, that's in inverted commas, poems, to being much more prepared not to understand.
Yeah.
And I love Rilke, who is pretty difficult, and Geoffrey Hill, who requires immense amounts of work, and Paul Celan, another German language poet, who's utterly incomprehensible, but I love reading Celan in German, which I can read, and English as well. I don't give a damn if I never understand any of the poems that Paul Celan wrote. I mean, I hope I'll live long enough to come into some sort of understanding of them, but it doesn't matter if I don't.
You enjoy Geoffrey Hill's work, yeah?
Yes, but laziness prevents me from reading it that often. It's such a pity, really. I berate myself for that, but I love it. I love the way he uses language. It's like, language is not a tool, it is the substance of the poetry. It's brilliant what he does, I think. But you have to know so much. That's part of the difficulty. But when you get a line, when you see what he's doing, it's worth it.
So your poetry is often characterised as being difficult and serious, and yet there's a lot of humour and lightness in it too, I find. One of your books, I can't remember which one, you actually acknowledged Salima Hill's Little Book of Meat for giving you back your sense of humour. Is that right? Had you lost your sense of humour at that point?
Do you know, I don't remember that, actually.
Right.
But yes.
It's in the front, it's either Blackthorn or... I took it in the Angel in front of one of those that you were.
Yes, there's a lot of humour in the sequence Nantucket and the Angel.
Yeah.
Yes.
And great poems in there, like The Swastika Spoon, for instance, and the other poem in 1945.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I noticed it almost seemed that the Second World War had an effect on you in a way which were unusual to say that you weren't born at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Is this because of your father's memories of his involvement in liberating Belsen, for instance?
Yes, I think so. And It was actually my father I got my sense of humour from, and right. I use it a lot in teaching. I love teasing people, and I suppose that kind of teasing comes into the poems as well. But it was only when I worked with asylum seekers very recently, I seemed to know how to work with the asylum seekers, and I didn't understand how I did know. But afterwards I understood that my father and his wartime experience and his not talking about it had taught me what I knew. And there was one asylum seeker in particular, and one weekend, I don't exactly remember how it came about, but then I understood then how my father hadn't been able to talk about a lot of his wartime experience, and particularly, I think, he was in a flame-throwing tank regiment, and they had, you know, took part in the burning down of Belsen. Not only that he wasn't able to talk about it, but that he needed, in a funny kind of way, he needed me and my sisters, his children, not to know about it, so that he could have a part of his life where it hadn't happened, almost. Something like that. Yeah. It was very dark, and it has taken me all these decades, really, to appreciate the size of that.
Yeah.
Yes. One of my earliest poems that I've never published, I don't think, was called Growing Up With No Memories of the War, because I felt, well, I might as well have been there. Yeah. And I think my parents and my mother's parents did have a difficult war. They were in Forest Hill in southeast London, and that was under the flight path of the German bombers, and their house, my mother's parents' house, and suffered sufficient bomb damage to move them out to Dorking in Surrey. And my father, although he wasn't called up because he was an architecture student, he wasn't called up till towards the end of the war, but he went over with the D-Day landings in 1944 and then spent the last year of the war on one place or another in Europe. And my mother's brother was the navigator in a Lancaster bomber, which was shot down in April 1943, and the whole crew were killed. And that brother, John, had also been a very early friend of my father's. So, obviously, for my mother's mother, my grandmother, that was completely devastating. So, so because they all really had a tough war, I think. And I have come to feel that it's up to, you know, my generation to unravel the war, that because we weren't there, and because we've had access to psychotherapy and other things that, you know, there was no time or place for immediately after the war. You just had to roll up your sleeves and get on with it and rebuild things. And
that's why there's no recognition of post-traumatic stress disorder at that time. You know?
That's right.
You're supposed to come home, put it out of your mind and get on with life, which must have been incredibly hard for many, many people.
And quite damaging for the next generation, I think. I mean, obviously, it was nothing in this country. It was nothing like it must have been for my generation in Germany. I mean, what I've heard, what I've read, you know, it's just so much more difficult, I think, but hard enough here. Yeah. Also.
Yeah, my own father was young in the way. He was like aged between 6 and 12, though. His memories of deprivation, really, you know, food rationing and never having any eggs or butter or chocolate, as he puts it, you know. That also must be very hard for a child, you know.
Yes. There's that poem of Libby Houston called The Mighty Banana. Do you know that one?
I don't know.
I can't remember any more of it, but it's wonderful because she's slightly older than I am. I think she was born in, 1945. But she remembers when bananas suddenly appeared in the shops again after the war.
Yes. Yeah, well, of course, there's that famous wartime song, Yes, We Have No Bananas. I hadn't really thought about it before. Okay, thanks a lot, Gillian. That was great.
That was Gillian Allnutt in conversation with Jeff Hattersley. You can find out more about Gillian on the RLF website. And that concludes episode 185, which was recorded by Jeff Hattersley and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 186, poet and novelist Martina Evans talks with Julia Kopis about her work as a hospital radiographer, the influence of dream lives, and why she said no to fiction. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.